Ausbruch.
Die Antirepressionswelle.
Nachrichten und Themenbeiträge zu Repression und Aktivismus.
Jeden vierten Sonntag auf RDL 102,3 MHz.
Hallöchen und unsere diesmonatige Ausbruchssendung, die ihr live bei Radio Dreieckland hören könnt oder sowieso im Netz, ist eine Spiegelung unserer ersten Bad News Ausgabe. Angry Voices from Around the World in English. Was ihr da alles in der Sendung erwartet, kommt im Vorclub auch in English, den ihr gleich nach dem Bad News Jingle hört. Und was da auch erwähnt wird, ist ein Bericht aus Syrien, Suwaidan Ground Bericht. Den habe ich rausgeschnitten. Den könnt ihr auf der Bad News Seite in quasi der kompletten Episode der Juli Bad News unter a-radio-network.org nachhören. Das hat leider nicht in die Stunde gepasst und ist auch sowieso nicht für jeden Moment geeignet, da es wirklich eine detaillierte Beschreibung von furchtbaren Dingen ist, die ja auf jeden Fall eine Content-Warnung haben. Eine Content-Warning. Also, wir wünschen euch ganz viel Spaß mit unserem neuen Format, damit ihr das auch mal gehört habt und euch weiter im A-Radio-Netzwerk auch informieren könnt. Und nächsten Monat hören wir uns dann wieder mit einer regulären Ausbruchssendung. Viel Spaß!
Bad News.
Bad News for the state.
Bad News for capital.
Bad News for patriarchy.
Bad News for all forms of domination.
Bad News. Angry voices from around the world.
Our monthly info show from anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio projects worldwide.
If these news are bad, I don't want to be good.
We are very happy to present our first bad news with this July 2025 bad news edition to you. We are Ausbruch, the anti-repression wave from Freiburg in Germany, and we are part of the A-Radio network since spring this year. This episode is made of three contributions from around the world of our A-Radio network, and we added a report of an anarchist activist that recently visited Syria and gave some shocking ground report from Suwaida, where conflicts escalated the last weeks. So the show will be finished after the final jingle, and the report from Syria will be added to the end. It lasts the last 30 minutes of this episode, and it's full of horror, so this is a content note on that. Take care of yourself and each other while listening to it, or maybe decide not to do. For the rest of the show, we have contributions from Jenna Lugna from Ljubljana, who spoke to Comrade about the development of radical Marxism in northern Nigeria. Anarchist Radio Berlin, who made an audio interview by a written one from the Indonesian journal Anarchy, who interviewed La Boina Anarquista, an anarchist news project from Chile. And also from Ausbruch, we made an interview with the Red Aid, der Roten Hilfe, about their work and current challenges. And it's meant to be in a row with other interviews on legal aid organizations that fight with us against repression worldwide, like Anarchist Black Cross or the different legal teams. So, enjoy the following bad news from July 2025.
No bastard ever came home from earning $8.25 an hour feeling proud. Minimum wage, just a fancy term for industrialized slavery. We're in a war with the privileged. Those aren't streets you're sitting on, they're battlefields. And it is our duty to fight the comfortable and the overfed. So go forth, you sons of bitches.
Iz bojišća razredne vojne poruča Črna Luknja.
In the interview, we will talk with a comrade from Nigeria. He will present some interesting insights of developing of radical Marxism in northern Nigeria.
First question is, what is the context where radical Marxism involved in North Nigeria?
Hello, it's really nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me. For the first question, you asked what is the context where radical Marxism evolved in northern Nigeria. I would say it would be immediately after World War II. Of course, you know, the colonies, after being taxed by the British, were already, due to the war, were already, you know, developing anti-imperialist sentiments. And with the beginning of the Cold War between communist Russia at that time and America, new ideas were being infused into the African territories of the European powers. And of course, there were the new elites, which were these class of students that were being taught under the English education system in the Nigerian context, and they were exposed to these ideas from their studies and also from communicating with other comrades from other African countries, and also communicating with comrades across multiple other countries that were aligned with the communist cause. And this led to the introduction of these ideas into the northern Nigerian environment, and from there it developed into a life of its own.
Okay, and how is radical Marxism in the region combining these Islamic principles, Marxist analysis, and the social context of the people?
Well, what you have to understand is that it was mainly a development or a brainchild of a person called Saadu Zungar, who in northern Nigerian context was actually the progenitor of what we call the anti-colonial movement in Nigeria. As I mentioned once, he made a famous proclamation or speech where he said that we will no longer let the sleeping dogs lie, we will wake them up and damn the consequences. So he had a very good cultural understanding of the people, and he knew that introducing these new concepts, which, let's be honest, they were Western ideas, you know, developed by Locke, Rousseau, on you know, democracy, liberalism, free speech. So it would have been a very difficult task, especially in our Islamic environment, to come and introduce these ideas, these foreign concepts. So what he did was that he took these Islamic principles that were already imbued into the people, and he looked for those ones that were kind of aligned with the Western ideals in some way, because let's be honest, no ideas are truly new. We're all human, and we all face similar circumstances, and we might come up with new terms for how we deal with these things, but they are all part of the general human experience. So he took those part of the Islamic experience or Islamic ideology that is somewhat aligned with the Western ideological movements towards democracy and liberalism, and then he applied a Marxist analysis to it as well. He, I would say, was a Puritan of Marxism, in which he didn't really look for a solution, whether towards communism or socialism or let's say anarchism. He took the Marxist critique of capitalism, applied it, you know, the class analysis between the people. He took the cultural language of the people and what they understand living within their environment, and he imbued it with Islamic principles. And of course, man is not an island, so he also took like lessons from other communalist African thoughts and movements, for example Ubuntu, and all of this made kind of a fusion which was incredible to see. An example that I would give, for example, is women's labor. You know, for years, women's labor, or centuries, I would say, has never been acknowledged. So what he did was that he recognized that women's labor was not acknowledged, and he put a Marxist analysis to it, where he was able to find the exchange value, like how much does women's labor actually cost for the household. And then in Islamic you know, jurisprudence, we have this concept of urf, or cultural context, where, you know, women were generally expected to work. But then also in Islamic principles, women do not have to actually work in the household. So what he was able to do was saying that, okay, within the cultural context, women are expected to work, but since Islamically they were not forced to work, why don't we take the exchange value of women and maybe make the husbands pay for it? Like, okay, if my wife is going to stay at home and sit down and take care of my household, she should be compensated for this. And you can see how this is a fusion of not only the cultural context but Islamic ideology and also Marxist analysis. And this can be seen in a lot of other ideas and initiatives that they came up with.
Interesting.
You were also mentioning these ideas were defined as radical Islam.
What you have to understand is that terms are just terms, and terms can be used in ways that are both positive and negative. So one example I would give is the swastika, right? It's typically a Buddhist symbol, which meant peace, but then the Nazis appropriated that symbol and made it into a symbol of horror. So in the same way, you know, Islamic radicalism, right, could be equated with, let's be honest, terrorist groups, right? But I think one of the ideas was to reappropriate this symbol and this terminology and direct it towards more positive ideas. And this is something that's happening even in contemporary times, where you have a large number of scholars, especially in northern Nigeria, reclaiming that term and using it and using Marxist analysis to make and Islamic principles to make a new field of study where you can analyze these things and you can call it by this term, and it can be meant for positive things like a more functioning democracy, a more equitable system.
In the progressive way,
exactly.
Actually going away from the dominant doctrine of the Islamism.
Exactly. Because let's be honest, it was just one person who even started the strain of radical Islamism that we associate with what we see today, which was Sayyid Qutb from Egypt. And if we allow only one person to define a legacy, at least of as a term as important of as this, we do a great disservice to language in of itself.
It's a collective project, so it's not one person or one ideology. It's humanity.
Of course.
Maybe
of course.
Can you tell us more about democratic humanism?
Okay. Well, democratic humanism is basically what I explained in the previous question, right? Where Saadu Zungur took all of these disparate ideologies, right, and he fused them together. Well, let me be honest, democratic humanism is not really a new term. It is a term that has Western ideological roots, but when it entered into Africa, you know, it developed a life of its own and it was subsumed into the cultural context. So, of course, you have famous writers such as Frantz Fanon and Marcus Garvey, which really moved the concept into Africa, but when it moved into the Nigerian concept, it developed also a life of its own, where Saadu Zungur stressed that, right, democracy is from the individual. In fact, he has a famous term where he said revolution is from below, right? It's from the people. And for him also, democracy was also an expression of freedom. Because remember, they were not fighting for one thing, they were fighting for two things, actually. Not only from freedom from the colonial elites, which were the British in this context, but for freedom from their own internal feudal leaders. And for them, democracy was an expression not only of external freedom, but also internal freedom within their society. And they believe that once you can have a democracy where everybody's voice is heard and that the human being is placed at the center. Remember, I noted that it's not the state that is at the center, and it's not the society at the center, but the human being is the center, where he can live his life freely, he can express his thoughts freely, and he can live under a society that is governed by the people who he elected in office. They believe that as true freedom. And then, of course, you have to fuse that with also humanist aspects, such as, you know, welfare, social progressism, and all these other aspects that make a life not only free, but worth living freely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this radical Marxism in northern Nigeria was for sure important part of the colonial struggle in Africa and all the other colonies. So maybe you can also tell a little bit how it was organized at that time.
Okay, so the primary person, thank you for the question, by the way. The primary question, the primary person that actually organized it in this way is his name is Aminu Kano, who he himself was a student of the person called Saadu Zungur. And one really interesting thing I find about his organization is that you have to remember that these people were teachers, actually. So in the British colonial system, they had experience from Sudan with people who they taught. And these people later became the revolutionaries. So what they did was that they really limited higher education for northern Nigerians, because it was a mostly Muslim society. So instead, what happened is that most of them were trained as teachers. But of course, they also made a mistake because teachers are really good at indoctrinating and teaching people how to, organize within society. So what Man Aminu Kano did was that he analyzed the people. He was like, okay, which messages resonate with the people? Who should I talk to? Where should I go? So one important thing is that the Hausa people are a Sahelian society, so near the deserts, where poetry is really important. So what they would do is they would write poetry, which can be memorized, right? But also, they also wrote verbal poetry, which it's like some of the lectures of Lacan, right? Where it's like an interactive session where you can talk to somebody or you say some phrases and then they reply to you. So in that way, you are learning. And also poetry, as you know, it's easier to memorize than prose. So you have to also remember that he was teaching butchers, market women. And remember, post-colonial Nigerian society, only like maybe 2 to 3 to possibly 10% of them were actually educated. So it was a really uneducated society. So they didn't even know what democracy was. So not only was he teaching them about Marxism and, this democratic humanism, he was also teaching them, okay, what are your rights? What are you expected to do in society? What do the senators do? What do the House of Representatives members do? What can you do with the police? And then he would go to, rallies. He would go to the market towns, market squares, and he would talk to these people. They would have, poetry sessions. They would have speeches. And for the elites, of course, he would write articles, write papers in Nigeria's premier northern newspaper at that time, which was Gaskia Tafikobo, which means in English, I guess, the truth is better than money. So he would, do all these things, organize the people for the elites. He had his own program for the non-elites. Of course, he would go and preach, go door to door, knocking on people's door, educating them on these things. And one other important thing that we should take note of is that there was a lot of discipline, messaging discipline with this. He didn't get sidetracked, talking about other higher things like a United States of West Africa, which was the dominant thing that was being talked about in terms of international relations between the colonies at that time. He stuck to the messaging that, look at what your elites are doing. Look at what the British are doing. You are not free. We want you to be free. We want you to get the benefits of democracy. And this is how we are going to do it. This is what you need to know about what your representatives are supposed to do. These are your rights. And then they move forward from that. And eventually they formed a large base of supporters.
And what is the contemporary legacy of this movement?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Thank you, Kofi. I would say that the contemporary legacy of it, especially in the northern Nigerian context, was, of course, immediately after Nigeria gained its independence, joined the non-aligned movement. It was part of the founding members together with Yugoslavia.
Yeah, when did it get
1960. So, and apart from that, of course, we have a free education system, universal basic education, just like we have it in Slovenia. Of course, because of corruption.
In Yugoslavia.
In Yugoslavia. Of course, you know, because of corruption and the problems of today, you know, those resources are strained, but it is still a sign of today. And even, you know, unions, trade unions, labor unions, all of them were given rights. And, you know, even in our constitution, you have the undeniable right to actually protest. It's written in the constitution. You don't even have to inform the police of your protest. This has been affirmed by our Supreme Court multiple times that, you know, it's a courtesy to tell the police that you're going to go to protest, but due to our laws, like, you have the right to protest, you know. So we have all of these things. And I would like you to note that it's not actually that these guys, like Aminu Kanu, won elections. They did win elections, actually, but only in the regional level. Like, maybe they won a governorship or two of a province and some House of Representative members. But I think the strongest legacy that they have in terms of how they moved the public discourse is that they opened the Overton window. They allowed the conversation to shift forward.
From below.
And, you know, you had conversations that came up that would have never came up if they didn't do this. You know, the conversations with the women's suffrage, like women in Northern Nigeria were not allowed to vote. And they were like, why aren't women allowed to vote? Like, they're allowed to vote in Southern Nigeria. So what are you infantilizing a woman that they don't have the capacity to vote? And they moved it so far that, you know, the government had to allow women to vote. They had to give rights and maternity care. They had to make education free because the window had shifted so much. I remember a particular quote by one of the feudal lords at that time, and he said that one of the greatest achievements that Malam Aminu Kanu ever did was that he taught our people how to say no. And I think that's very powerful when you have a state conditioning or consensus building where it tells you that, you know, the government has to have a paternalistic a relationship with you where they know better than you about how to live your own life. If you can tell the people that, no, you guys elected these people and these people are here to serve you, so you should be the one telling them how it is and what you believe. They're your representatives. They're not supposed to, you know, be your lords.
Madonna, se to ikuš ko kurda bahajka. Barbadat se mož pa je. Ampak se tule ni nobenega reda, nobene discipline. Se sploh ne veš, kdo komandira. Vsak ima besedo.
Na svobodo se pripravljajo, to je tist.
Na svobodo vas pripravlja Črna luknja. Anarhistični glas na Radiu Študent.
What motivated you to create this counter-information newspaper?
Hello, good day. Well, the platform began as a newspaper edited precariously with Word. What motivated us was that nearly 11 years ago, in 2013, when the waves of the student movement in Chile were present, we started researching and came across a book about anarchist propaganda in Chile. We were amazed by how much of it existed in the 1920s. Around that time, there were other physical format newspapers. El Surco, 2009 to 2013. Amanecer, from Chillán, in central southern Chile, 2011 to 2013. El Sol Acrata, from Calama, northern Chile, 2011 to 2024. Acracia, from Valdivia, far south of Chile, 2012 to 2019. And Solidaridad, a libertarian communist newspaper aligned with the branch closest to Especifismo or Platformism, 2010 to 2016. It was within this context that we decided to found a newspaper called Periódico La Boina in 2014, which only released 7 issues. Financial problems, time constraints, and lack of coordination led to its discontinuation, but we noticed that the website's visits kept growing, reaching over 100,000 per year. The need to communicate, reflect, critique, share, and discuss with other comrades enriches our ideas and fosters camaraderie, especially through printed propaganda. What I see as a downside, and sometimes we are also guilty of, is that there's a lot of digital propaganda circulating on social media. While it's positive to have more contact with comrades from other places, the information becomes more instantaneous, preventing deeper reflection. It also introduces anxiety over likes, making everything faster. We believe it's necessary to return to printed propaganda without neglecting the digital. It's essential to discuss and reflect as the anarchists of the past used to do.
In our informal conversation, you mentioned your involvement in a historical archive project. Could you tell us more about it?
I'm currently part of a group called Archivo Histórica La Revuelta, which has existed since 2009. The mission of the archive is to preserve the memory of anarchist history. Archivo La Revuelta publishes a magazine called A Contratiempo, where we present research by comrades on the history of anarchism in Chile and elsewhere. The issue is that, according to some historians, anarchism arrived in Chile in the 1890s and lasted until 1930. When the last mass anarchist unions existed, of course there were exceptions in the 1950s and 1960s, and we have found active comrades in the 1970s, but they are marginal compared to the Marxist groups. After the period, anarchism experienced a revival, gradually growing with counterculture and punk in the 1990s. So the archive has the mission of preserving anarchist memory in this region, both from the 20th century and from the late 1990s and early 2000s. There are many struggles led by younger comrades, as young as 16 years old, who may not be as familiar with the struggles fought in the early 2000s, for example. That's why the archive doesn't just focus on the history of anarchism from 100 years ago, but also on the present. We aim to collect and reconstruct the history of anarchism from the 1990s, when there were many scenes and first newspapers, to understand what interested comrades of those years, to share those struggles and discussions with younger comrades so they can learn about the efforts and ideas of those who came before them. On the other hand, anarchist research has emerged in recent years. Its main historians might include Eduardo Godoy, Manuel Lagos, or study groups like the Grupo de Estudio José Domingo Gómez Rojas, which has the editorial Eleuterio. Currently, the archive operates in a physical space called Casa Anarquista La Demita, which is shared with other anarchist projects. Also with comrades dedicated to research, we are also organizing the 4th Congress on Research about Anarchism in Santiago, October 2025. The first Congress was held in Buenos Aires in Argentina in 2016. Its second edition was in Montevideo, Uruguay in 2019. And Sao Paulo, Brazil in 2022.
People from non-Latin American countries are often surprised by the growing anarchist tensions in Chile, especially the diversity of the anarchist movement, its rejuvenation among the youth, and the intense repression anarchists face while maintaining combative and insurrectionary actions. What makes all this possible?
That's a complex and good question. Let's take it step by step. First, anarchism in Chile lost its influence around 1930, following a populist proto-fascist dictatorship led by Carlos Ibáñez de Campo. It continued to exist, but with diminished social impact. Decades later, during Pinochet's dictatorship from 1973 to 1990, a plebiscite was held to decide whether he would continue in power. The no won in 1988, leading to the return of democracy in Chile. However, the former dictator remained commander-in-chief of the army, and many aspects of the dictatorship were incorporated into the new democracy, such as the 1980 constitution, the neoliberal economic model, and Pinochet's privileged status within the state. Even the arrest of Pinochet in London in 1998 and his subsequent rescue by the center-left Concertación coalition further cemented dissatisfaction with the new democratic transition. This dissatisfaction, combined with the commemorations of the 500th anniversary of the Spanish invasions of the Americas, fueled a critical leftist resurgence. In that context, the first demonstration where anarchists became visible took place during the quincentenary in October 1990. Secondly, discontent was reorganized. Punk flourished and various identity-based struggles, anti-militarism, feminism, vegetarianism, LGBTQ rights, Mapuche rights, and human rights gained prominence. Alongside the growth of the extra-parliamentary left, anarchism saw a cultural renaissance. While older anarcho-syndicalists active in the 1950s had limited influence on the young punks and dissenters, these youth revived the movement almost from scratch. Besides that, since the 2000s, an Occupa movement, squatters, turning abandoned houses into cultural centers. These Occupa houses were fundamental to revitalize the anarchist movement. Third, in a neoliberal context where the state provides no social safety net, the people versus capital or state conflict intensifies, fueling discontent because the state doesn't answer the people's needs. In our view, this makes it easier for critics of the state in neoliberal countries in comparison to social democratic states. Everything in Chile, education, healthcare, pensions, even water, is commodified, making the enemy both the state and capital, which are seen as indistinguishable. This dynamic has sparked uprisings, including the Mapuche resistance, with the creation of the Coordinadora Arucomayeco in 1997, major protests against APAC in 2004, and the resurgence of the student movement in 2001, 2006, and 2011. In this way, anarchism grows into Chilean discontent, with the appearance of many collectives and some ideas of making a federation that finally breached. Fourth, direct actions, such as bombings of banks and financial institutions, have shaped the public perception of anarchism. For instance, the tragic death of Mauricio Morales in 2009 brought widespread media attention to anarchism, sparking curiosity among many. Events like the Caso Bombas 2010 to 2012 revealed irregular evidence and questionable investigations, highlighting state repression and inadvertently strengthening anarchist propaganda. Fifth, in Chile, subversive culture inspired by a revolutionary leftist organization from the dictatorship era, for example, MIR, Mapu Lautaro, FPMR, feeds anarchism with imagery of bank heists, explosive devices and Molotov cocktails. While these actions aren't ideologically anarchist, they inspire a subversive ethos. What makes it possible is the existence of a subversive culture of Molotovs and a decentralization of struggles. However, excessive decentralization and individualism have led to a lack of coordination, which is fundamental to anarchism and something Chilean anarchism lacks. Anarchism in Chile is very diverse, but also scattered and perhaps somewhat uncoordinated.
In Chile, there are events like the Day of the Young Combatant to keep alive the memory of those who fell in the struggle. How much does this commemoration of fallen combatants influence society?
The Day of the Young Combatant commemorates the death of two brothers from a Guevarist leftist organization during the dictatorship. Eduardo, 20 years old, and Rafael, 18, Vergara Toledo, militants of the Revolutionary Left Movement, MIR. Also, it is the anniversary or commemoration of an entire revolutionary left. Anarchism has been reclaiming this commemoration, originally rooted in the revolutionary left. For society in general, it is just another day to get home early, as there might be clashes with the police in neighborhoods or communities, making it potentially dangerous. In fact, a segment of society has renamed the Day of the Young Combatant the Day of the Young Delinquent. For the left, it's a day of remembrance, and for the more revolutionary lefts and anarchists, it's a day of combative memory. At a societal level, it doesn't contribute much, but through the fallen, we are recognized, as the fallen are acknowledged by the press. For example, many people don't know what anarchism is, but associate anarchists with bomb planting, because an anarchist named Mauricio Morales planted a bomb in 2009. While this is a crude caricature and reductionist perspective, anarchism exists in society and the press, whereas in other countries like Peru, for example, it wouldn't make the news. The fallen make us recognizable in societies, but not in substance. Half of the graffiti say things like Tortuga Presente or Punky Mauri. Political culture revolves around the fallen. Political prisoners on the streets, Punky Mauri Presente, but it doesn't engage much with our everyday oppressions or systematic critique. One weakness of anarchism in Chile is creating a proactive political culture and a critique of the system that resonates with Chile's most oppressed, beyond political prisoners and martyrs, who are extremely important but lack broader connection with most people suffering under capitalism. Although there is proactive propaganda, it is much scarcer than the other kind. Personally, I believe the two must go hand in hand. Proposals, denunciation of political prisoners and remembrance of comrades. The past, the fallen, the present political prisoners, and the future, what we propose or aim for, what we want.
By normalizing combative action, Chileans seem ready for any general uprising. How did the movement achieve this diversity of tactics? Are there debates or even internal divisions on the matter?
There is a normalization of political revolutionary violence, because it never stopped. Since the dictatorship, perhaps the actors have changed. In the last 20 years, anarchists have taken the lead, whereas previously it was the revolutionary left, Leninist or Guevarist. However, this doesn't mean we are prepared for a social uprising or revolt. There is a normalization where, in moments of conflict or rebellion, people know what to do, such as clashing with the police, burning private property, or destroying infrastructure. But a revolt involves more than just normalizing violence. It's demanded by the struggle and the repression it faces. For this, there is no preparation. There's also a lack of coordination with others or mutual aid. We are never fully prepared, and the revolt exposes our weaknesses. Mutual aid exists, but it's scarce, as are cooperative projects, which do exist and are valuable experiences. For many anarchists, the conflict is more alluring, which is fine, but as I said before, conflict must go hand in hand with proactive proposals to create the new world we believe in. For example, during the social revolt, many anarchists improvised their actions because anarchist nihilism and individualism prevailed, at least in Santiago. There was a sense that revolution is not possible, only conflict with authority. Freedom wasn't seen as achievable through revolution, but through conflict, as it seemed almost impossible for society to rebel against its masters. However, they were wrong. Society did rebel. The question is, where were the anarchists? Disorganized and uncoordinated, though adept at resisting repression and street violence. But there was a lack of construction. Where are we going? What's our roadmap? As Malatesta used to say, we need a program. Unfortunately, anything that sounds like program or organization is perceived as platformist or bureaucratic, which stagnates us. We need both affinity groups, spontaneous revolutionary violence, and organization planning and strategy. There's a lack of synthesis from our perspective. Therefore, no, we are not ready for revolt.
Can you tell us how much support the struggle for the Mapuche people's autonomy has in Chilean society, and what contribution do anarchists make to this struggle?
The Mapuche struggle has a significant impact on society, because the Mapuche have organized since the 1980s, confronting the racism in Chilean society. For example, my mother lived in Temuco, and in the 1990s, supermarkets would serve her before Mapuche women, a clear example of racism. In 1997, truck burnings marked the beginning of the Coordinadora Arauco Mayeco, CAM, which in one of its statements rejected both Marxism and anarchism as European ideologies. Many leftists support the struggle for the restitution of lands usurped during the 19th century, pacification of the Araucania, and the 20th century expansion of latifundistas. Leftists, whether progressive, revolutionary, or anarchists, often support the struggle, especially after the killings of Alex Nemun and Matthias Catrileo, the latter an anarchist punk in his youth. There are different types of support. In the south, several armed Mapuche organizations exist. CAM, Resistencia Mapuche Mayeco, Vaichan Auco Mapu, and the Mapuche National Liberation Movement. Many resort to political violence, such as burning forestry trucks or reclaiming land, as they view transnational timber companies and latifundistas as their primary enemies, not Chileans, whom they also see as oppressed by the capital and the state. Many Chileans support this, but among progressives, some believe the truck burnings or attacks are police setups, right-wing political schemes, or acts by businessmen themselves. This denies the violence of the oppressed against oppressors. The more revolutionary left and anarchist groups do not believe in the setup theory. Also, that up exists, not everything is one. They affirm the oppressed's legitimate right to use political violence against oppressors. Solidarity is shown through protests or ceremonies for the fallen, especially on October 12th, which commemorates the arrival of invaders to the Americas. It's important to note, however, that some comrades claim that while we show great solidarity with the Mapuche struggle doesn't reciprocate much support for Chilean social struggles. This highlights contradictions within social movements.
And an additional question, please share your thoughts or anything you'd like to say that was not asked in this brief interview. There are no limits.
Sometimes we comrades believe that anarchism in Chile is romanticized, often referred to as the Greece of Latin America. While there is indeed a significant subversive culture and anarchists occasionally make headlines, we believe there is a lack of coordination. There are many organizations, but they do not focus on envisioning a future or drafting a program, nor is there much thought given to building large-scale organizations. I think we need to reflect on this. I would also like to add that some comrades and I feel there is currently stagnation. The movement that grew from 2006 to 2019 no longer seems to be present. It is said that after the uprising and the democratic referendums meant to channel public discontent, many people became disillusioned, no longer want to fight. Adding to this, we are now governed by progressivism, which promised to change Chile's economic system, promise that remains unfulfilled. There is a sense of demotivation among the Chilean people. On other note, there is a growing xenophobia towards the Venezuelan population. This stems partly from cultural differences, but also from the rise in organized crime and drug trafficking. Chile remains one of the safest countries in the region, but its population is among the most fearful of crime. This has led to the state arming itself not only against crime and drug traffickers, but also against social organizations that question political and economic power structures.
The Rote Hilfe is a big anti-repression organization in Germany. We, from Ausbruch Freiburg, spoke to two activists of Rote Hilfe Freiburg about their daily anti-repression work and how the Rote Hilfe is structured in Germany. I'm sitting here with two persons from Rote Hilfe Freiburg. Maybe you can introduce yourself first.
Hello, I'm David from the Rote Hilfe here based local chapter in Freiburg.
And I'm Zora. Hello.
Good to have you. First of all, can you tell a bit what is the Rote Hilfe and what is it there for?
Yes, sure. So the Rote Hilfe, or Red Aid translated, is a cross-factional anti-repression organization based in mainly in Germany, but we speak about this a little bit later on maybe. We support people who face state repression because of their political engagement. This includes a big variety of less leftist, anti-fascist, feminist, environmental, and other emancipatory movements. Our work is based on solidarity, so we don't ask what someone is accused of. It's just if someone is targeted for standing up against injustice, they deserve support in our opinion.
And how did it come that the Rote Hilfe was founded? What's the origin or history of it?
It actually has a pretty long history for more than 100 years already. It all started in the 1920s when the huge international communist movement started to support prisoners. So people who were striking, being workers, anti-fascist and communist, get into prison. They supported the prisoners and also their families. The movement, like the organization, was destroyed by the Nazis, and there only survived some grassroots little groups, but they were not organized in a bigger picture anymore. And it all came back in the 1970s in West Germany when the leftist movement was facing a huge repression again. And there the Rote Hilfe became present again.
So you look back on quite a history. And how does now your daily work today look like? How are you organized these days?
I come to this question, but first maybe one thing, because last year, 2024, we became 100 years old, basically. So, and for this event, we also look deeper in the history of Rote Hilfe. So if anybody's interested in like 100 years of anti-repression work, one could go to the website and look up brochures or even a we have a movie as well, and also a exhibition with like lots of information how we founded, how it got destroyed, and how it built up again. Yes. So just this little information. So now for your question, the usual work and how we organized. So we are organized as a decentralized network with local groups all across Germany, maybe a little bit in Switzerland and a little bit in Austria as well. So these groups work autonomously for themselves, but we all share common values and practices. And also the exchange is very important between these groups. So there are regular coordinations, meetings on federal level. Between regional groups, but also nationwide working groups. So it's quite complex, and we try to see each other like actually very often, to ensure coherence and mutual support across the whole country, basically. So we are also in digital contact basically, and there's a big base of knowledge basically as well, so where we can exchange. So here in Freiburg, our daily work includes, for example, legal support, helping with costs for lawyers and fines, and being there for the people emotionally, as far as we can, and mainly politically, during court cases or also imprisonment. And we also run workshops, write legal guides, and help activists also prepare for possible repression. So the basic idea is no one should have to face the state alone.
That sounds good. And do you know about any similar structures in Germany? Are there other groups where you are working with, or also in other countries? You already spoke about Switzerland and Austria.
Yes, absolutely. There are quite many groups, luckily. So besides Rote Hilfe here in Germany, there is EA, Ermittlungsausschuss, who's supporting people who are facing repression and also doing like a demonstration watch. But you will hear about it more from the EA. There are other groups who are also internationally organized, like the ABC, the Anarchist Black Cross, who started from like an anarchist movement and is supporting prisoners on an international perspective. And there is also Azadi, a group that is supporting people who, like Kurdish people who face repression from a state side. And then there are, of course, also like autonomous cop watch groups all over Germany and in other countries as well. What is unique with Rote Hilfe is on the one side that we are pretty big. So it's an association. There are almost 18,000 members who make it possible not only to support people from like a political perspective, but also financially. And we, with this financial contribution, we can guarantee a stable and broad base to provide concrete solidarity and financial support. And it also makes it possible to not only respond to repression, but also to prepare for it and prepare people who face repression in court cases, but also going to prison and have like prison support groups, etc.
And if people now need to get in contact with you, how can they do it, and what's happening then?
So getting in touch with us, normally it's pretty easy if people know us. So as we already said, we have local groups in all around Germany or the German-speaking countries. So the best thing is to go to these local groups and speak about the case you have. Otherwise, you can also just visit the website, rote-hilfe.de. So either you write directly, or the best thing would be to search for your local group on this website and write the local group directly. The email communication is very reliable, I would say. We like to write also encrypted emails through PGP. Normally every local Rote Hilfe group has a PGP encryption. That's a big plus when dealing with sensitive information. That said, you can also contact us without PGP, of course, and you will get a response, and we will help you out as well. So if someone is facing repression, whether it's a police search, an arrest, or court case, so it's a variety of repression, You can just reach out to us. We help to connect them with experienced lawyers, explain legal processes, take the fear away, and yeah, in many cases we can help cover legal and trial related costs as well. So yeah, more than that, we make sure people aren't left alone. Like, that's the base we are working on, because we don't see solidarity as a service. So we are not a people who give a service. It's something we are practicing together as well.
And I assume that's quite a lot of work to do, but how is it currently? Are there any challenges or things where your work is affected by the current political situation when you are working all over the German-speaking countries?
Yes, when we reflect it, we would say that there is a deeper crisis based on capitalism and nationalism that is also affecting our work. So we are facing like a structural deadlock, not only socially, but also economically and ecologically, and militarization is the answer. So the system is shifting to the right, and more nationalism also means more repression. So at this time, there are criminal trials like Antifa Ost or the so-called Budapest Complex, where anti-fascists are harshly being targeted. People are facing very long prison sentences, and the repression is sending a clear signal to trying to make people struggle or stop their political work. It is alarming, and not only the anti-fascist movement, but also the climate activism is we see a growing number of civil lawsuits, and this means very massive financial repression. So it has the clear aim to intimidate and isolate. And it is a work which is very important to not only stand beside, but to do something against that.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
And with all this work, how can people support you? How can they give donations, support your work, take part?
Actually, there's a wide variety to support. So yeah, as just stated, times get harsh, so it's very important to come together and to solidarize as well. So you can, of course, become a member to Rote Hilfe and give monthly donations. That's basically the financial base we are working on. And this also takes away the fear of activists if they have to pay money to the state for their activism. So, first thing is to become a member from Rote Hilfe. You can also support like one-time donations as well. We are always collecting money for current cases, basically. As stated, Antifa Ost, for example, all this costs a lot of money. Or the climate activists, they're the civil right lawsuits as well. That's kind of another way of repression. From the private sector, this also costs a lot of money, like let's say 45,000 euros for a block of some refineries or something. So also one-time donations super nice, or of course getting active as well, maybe in the local Rote Hilfe group. There's a lot of work. Basically, we could also do more, go into prevention, talk to younger activists who newly come into the movement, and talk to them like that we are here and how we work and everything. So that's also a very nice way of supporting, like get organized, like it's really the time for it. Or like also talk to friends and comrades about repression, what's the way out of it. You can also get the info and material from our website. Informated yourself, speak to your friends, like share this information. Sharing is caring. That's also a nice way to support us or like yourself or your movement as well. prepare together and don't let the fear isolate us. It's very important, because in the end, the solidarity is our strongest tool in this crisis.
And solidarity isn't a service, it's something we practice together. So let's practice.
Yes.
Указую вам да пренехате с кашитвио јавнега реда и миру.
We're right in the middle of Sindagma Square right now. Police is behind me.
Many police officers have been hurt. Men and women who are trying to protect democratically elected leaders.
Bad news. Angry voices from around the world. Local anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio shows on one spot.
Tune in every 15th of the month.
More information on a-radio-network.org.
What's a revolution to you? To kill their bosses and take their money.
The July 2025 episodes of Bad News ends here, and the audio continues with a report from Soweto, Syria. It was shared with a network of anarchists on Monday, 21st of July, and we only publish it now as they have safely departed Syria and have asked for the following to be shared. There's a content warning. The following audio is a discussion of violence and murder in detail. Decide if you want to hear this now and take care of yourself and each other.
Den Groundbericht aus Syrien, den ihr eben in der Juli Bad News Edition erwähnt gehört habt und der auch dort mit der Content-Warnung versehen war, den könnt ihr auf a-radio-network.org in der genannten vollen Juli-Episode unserer ersten Bad News nachhören. Und das war Ausbruch, die Antirepressionswelle diesen Monat mit Bad News in Englisch. Wir sind nämlich jetzt neu Teil des A-Radio-Netzwerkes, einer anarchistischen, antiautoritären Radio-Vernetzung global mit vielen verschiedenen tollen Radios aus Chile und Griechenland und Ljubljana und Berlin und. Checkt's aus, www.a-radio-network.org. Und uns hört ihr wieder am vierten Sonntag im Monat. Und falls ihr in der Zwischenzeit irgendwie Stress mit Justiz- und Vollzugsbehörden haben solltet, wendet euch an den EA Freiburg oder die Rote Hilfe Freiburg. Die jeweiligen Sprechstunden findet ihr bei tacker.fr. Und ich sage tschüss, für euch am Mikro war Max und bis bald. Passt auf euch auf und lasst euch nicht erwischen.